Call the meeting to order. Good morning, everybody. First, I'll call for motion and second for approval of the minutes of the last regular meeting on October 11th, 2017.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Curtis, I guess we've got all the commissioners here today, I think, which so we don't have to excuse anybody. Curtis, the executive director's report.
Great. Good morning, commissioners. Welcome. And to our visitors, welcome. First, I'd like to acknowledge our safety champions who have been rotating up here on that. There we go. On the video, a nice variety of port folks up there, dredge and administration and maintenance. So again, shout out to the folks who are really going the extra mile to help ensure that everyone who comes to work every day goes home in the same or better state than when they arrived. And Stan, if you're ready, would welcome a safety message this morning.
Sure. Well, it's definitely autumn now. Weather's getting cooler. Leaves are falling from the trees. And so it's important to keep a few maybe important fall safety tips in mind. So with proper precautions and safety awareness that we can all avoid potential hazards that come with the fall season. So with the weather turning colder, a lot of people are spending more time inside their homes. They're using their fireplaces, their furnaces, space heaters to stay warm. And so we need to keep these tips in mind. Practice good fireplace safety. Ensure that you have a screen to prevent sparks from flying out of your fireplace. Use caution with space heaters and especially keep them away from any flammable surfaces. There's a lot of fires that are caused by space heaters during this time of the year. It's also a good time to change your smoke alarm batteries and test to ensure that they are working properly. I think it was just 2 weeks ago we had a fire and some deaths in the Portland area, and it was determined that their smoke alarms were not working properly. Outside your home, make sure that you clean up leaves to prevent slipping around your home. Wear proper clothing and footwear outside of your house. And when you're coming to work, areas to be aware of for slips and falls, pay special attention around doorways, uneven surfaces, areas that may become wet, ramps, and stairways. And if you're putting up holiday lights, I know we may not think about that right now, but I won't talk to you again until December, and a lot of people put them up after Thanksgiving. So if you are putting up holiday lights, make sure you check your lights for any frayed wires. And if you do have exposed wires, toss those lights. Don't try and tape them up and use them. Also, do not put them up by yourself. It's really good to make sure someone is around when you're putting your lights up, just in case you fall. And it's also important to have someone help hold the ladder when you're putting your lights up. And lastly, with fewer hours of daylight, drive safely. Also, with the colder weather, you may want to check your tire pressure. Your tire pressures have dropped because of the colder weather. And it's also maybe a good idea to put a flashlight in your car just in case, so that you have proper lighting in case you may need it. And so hopefully with these tips and general safety awareness, we can all have a safe fall and holiday season.
Thank you, Stan.
Yep.
Appreciate it. I know my 5-year-old and 6-year-old daughters and I had a fire alarm test last weekend at 2 a.m. It was an errant fire alarm. That's always a fun way to do it with no smoke or fire. Commissioners, I'm sorry I missed our last commission meeting. I was, as I think was reported, on a trade mission with the governor to Hong Kong and to Japan. It was a very successful trip. She did a great job, and we spent actually a very meaningful day with our friends at Swire Resources and Cathay Pacific in Hong Kong, and hopefully we'll have more news about that later this year. You may have noticed out on the roadway, we did some work over the last couple months on the terminal roadway to reduce congestion and help enhance flow through the roadway area. You'll notice better signage, a little clearer identification of where pickup and drop-off is. And on the lower roadway, we're really focused on this really increased traffic in the transportation network companies. So if you're a Lyft rider, hopefully you'll see more space down there for rideshare companies. Some exciting news, 2 new flights to announce. First, Alaska Airlines launched nonstop service connecting PDX to New York's JFK Airport, another great option for accessing an important hub for business travelers in particular, but also for those of you looking to go see Springsteen on Broadway. This is the flight. It's going to be perfect. Commissioner Alexander, I see you thinking about making your plans. As long as we're talking about Springsteen, think about a dream, try to make it real. Badlands quote of the week. We have been thinking for a long time about connections into Mexico, and we are now making it real. We're going to be seeing service start from Aeromexico, from PDX direct to Mexico City on December 1st. It is seven flights a week. It's really a great opportunity for us, opening up Latin America to travelers in the Portland region. Just a fantastic chunk of work leading to this successful announcement. And, it's times like this that we forget how far we've really come in the past 10 or so years from really one international destination to now 12. It's just been great for the region. Last week, PDX welcomed another small business, Poblano Pepper, to the PDX Food Cart program as Cacalac Chicken Shack rotated out. So new opportunities there. Poblano Pepper is a family-owned and operated Mexican food cart with another location down in southeast on Belmont. Tomorrow, in this nice cold weather that Stan referenced, is the PDX Fall Cleanup, where we encourage our airport partners to donate old and used large items, furniture, into local nonprofits and rebuild centers. It's an event part of our larger effort to minimize waste in all aspects of what we do at PDX. Port police officers have been working additionally with students from Latino youth groups at Fort Vancouver High School and Hudson Bay High School to design and create a mural that will be displayed in the terminal near the police department. That mural features several important historical figures, including the first African-American police detective, Paul Cephas Howell, and the first female police officer in Oregon, Lola Baldwin. We're having a short dedication at that mural site, I believe, next week on the 16th. The Hillsborough Airfare took place on September 21st, a few weeks ago. It did rain, but 600 people managed to show up, and it was very successful. Really a great set of aviation-oriented family activities, helping people understand what goes on at Hillsborough Airport. And then finally, again, in a bit of rain, this past weekend was our annual employee volunteer event for the port and port families at the Sandy River Basin tree planting. It took place in Troutdale with Friends of Trees and other local partners, another great event with port members and port staff and their families participating. So, Mr. President, that is my comments for the morning.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Motion to approve the executive director's report.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thanks. Motion carries. It's now a time for public comments. If there are people who have signed up to speak, Stefan Moritz, I know you have, so come on up. Good morning.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Stefan Moritz. I'm with Unite Here Local 8, the union representing food service workers here at Portland Airport. Last commission meeting, I thought we finally had a decent discussion here about some of the issues that we're facing at the Portland Airport. I want to thank the commissioners who participated in that discussion because I thought it was a good constructive start. Unfortunately, instead of taking that as a basis to problem solve together, the port staff decided to trash the partnership with labor here. Last month's article in the Willamette Week crossed the line of basic decency and showed that there's no interest apparently on the part of staff and leadership at the Port of Portland to have a good relationship or rational and good faith discussions with our organization. Portland staff managed to throw hundreds of low-wage workers under the bus. Workers who on average make less than $12 an hour struggle to pay rent and support their families, all while working hard to please customers. They are the main reason the Port of Portland is winning customer service awards every year. As a union of low-wage workers, we refuse to accept that poverty is part of the unique local flavor at PDX. We refuse to accept the ridiculous idea that good jobs are incompatible with a unique airport. While the Port of Portland collects massive amounts of rents from its restaurants, Portland airport workers have some of the lowest wages and worst benefits of any airport on the West Coast. The article makes the stunning assertion that Unite Here wants to kick local businesses out of the Portland airport. And the quotes by the port staff deliberately support that narrative. It is not Unite Here Local 8's goal to limit Portland airport to just two concessions operators. And your staff paints a picture to the contrary. Unlike the port staff, our union has moved with the times and has learned to work with all airport stakeholders to do it all. We want good jobs, local businesses, unique ideas, and satisfied customers. As a local union representing local workers, we're committed to working with local stakeholders to figure out which solutions make the most sense for Portland. I want to give you a few examples. At the Seattle airport, Unite Here Local 8, for example, is working on a dramatic expansion of local offerings all over the airport. And I'm involved in this effort every day. At San Francisco Airport, which uses a similar concessions leasing model to PDX, Unite Here Local 2 has dozens of union contracts with thriving small businesses, resulting in some of the best airport restaurant jobs in the country. Of their 69 dining locations, approximately 85% are local businesses. Finally, Unite Here does not want to raise prices on customers. Street pricing policies are common in the industry and not unique to Portland. 92% of airports that responded to a survey have pricing restrictions on their stores and restaurants. But low prices should not come on the backs of low-wage workers. Airport restaurants are expensive to operate because of the required capital investment and stringent security rules. It is dishonest to say that the street pricing doesn't pose a challenge for both workers and employers, especially small businesses. Solving this problem will require a change in attitude from the Port of Portland. What we need is a good faith effort by those in charge of this public facility to actually seek creative solutions and create the space for businesses and workers to succeed. We are ready to work with the stakeholders here at the airport, to name a few. We have relationships with SSP, HMS Host, and Walt Duty Free, which you know about, but we also ready to work with local folks like Bambusa, for example. We can work together to make this airport better. That we just got quoted a price tag of $12,000 for a straightforward public disclosure request is another sign that folks in this institution are not ready for that effort. To pretend that the rest of the airport world still looks like it did 20 years ago and to make that argument based on old and tired anti-union stereotypes is wrong. And I know that Kristen Leonard, Chris Sonecki, and the other port leadership know better than that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments before you run off there, Stefan? There may be anyone have a question or comment? Thanks. And just so you do know, Stefan, in response to our continued concern about how the concessions operate, there will be in the near future an effort to continue to develop information from all perspectives and stakeholders. So I don't think you should feel like we're ignoring your comments, but it will take some time to get a detailed analysis of all perspectives, and yours will be welcome as well. Thank you. Any other public comments? Bob Burkett and Moss Adams are next on our list here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're here today to present to you the Port's annual audit reports, give you an overview of our fiscal 2017 results, and for our external auditors, Moss Adams, to present you their reports and required communications from the audits they performed. So first, you've received a stack of reports from us. Those reports include the Port's audited financial statements, the blue cover. This is the report on the Port's financial performance for the year ending June 30th, 2017. The port's report on federal awards regarding federal funding compliance, and this is a report required for entities like the port that receive significant federal funding. And then the port's passenger facility charge report as required by the FAA. The FAA requires an annual audit report for airports that impose a PFC. So for the audience, there's hard copies on the back table if you'd like a memento of today's presentation. In addition, we've given you copies of the representation letters that we've provided to Moss Adams pursuant to their audit work. You also have a copy of Moss Adams' presentation that they'll cover as soon as I'm done here. So each of these reports serves a different purpose, but all of the reports include the port's basic financial statements, which summarize the results for the fiscal year and the port's financial position as of June 30, 2017. I'll take a few minutes to briefly review some of the information in each of the three reports before I hand the presentation over to Moss Adams. So we'll start with information from the blue report. If I move the slides along, sorry. We start with income statement data for PDX, which shows revenues and expenses for the fiscal years ending June 30, 2017 and 2016. And on the first line, operating revenues, they appear flat year over year. But in fiscal 16, there was $10.8 million for the one-time billing of the airlines for the terminal balancing design change write-off. And then in fiscal 17, we had higher airline concessions, rental car and parking revenues as a result of record passenger activity. We had 18.8 million passengers come through in fiscal 17. The next line, operating expenses excluding depreciation, they were about $15 million lower in fiscal 17. Fiscal 16 had that one-time $10.8 million terminal balancing write-off, as well as about $7.5 million in higher non-cash accounting expense for pensions. This was partially offset by higher personnel services expense in fiscal 17. The third line, operating income before depreciation, is simply the math, operating revenues less the operating expenses excluding depreciation. And then depreciation expense is up about $4.5 million in fiscal 17 as more assets have come online. Over the next 5 to 10 years, as we move into this period of capital expansion, we'll expect to see that number continue to increase as those assets come online as they're completed. And then the non-operating income, it's up about $1 million in fiscal year 17 as a result of the higher PFC revenues from record emplacements, plus higher interest income from higher cash balances and slightly higher interest rates, offset in part by a reimbursement from PDX for demolition performed by tenants on our behalf. So then we add some balance sheet information at the bottom of the page. This table shows the June 30 balances for assets, liabilities, and net position. Net position is the mathematical difference between assets and liabilities, and is commonly called equity in the private sector. You can see both assets and liabilities increased during the year, but the assets increased by about $53 million more than liabilities, and the net increase is primarily due to net income and capital grants that we received during the fiscal year. So all in all, it was another strong year for PDX. So now we move on to some high-level income statement data for the general fund. The general fund's also referred to as marine and other in the reports that we've given you. First line, fiscal 17 operating revenues increased pretty dramatically over fiscal year 16. It was primarily due to land sales revenues that were nearly $24 million higher in fiscal 17, as well as the lease termination payment in cash and assets that we received for the Terminal 6 container facility. The next line, fiscal 17 operating expenses excluding depreciation, they were about $9 million higher than fiscal 16, which was due about $15 million it was about $15 million higher for cost of property expense related to those higher property sales numbers. Plus personnel services expense was up a bit, and this was offset in part by about $9 million in lower non-cash pension expense. We then have the math where we calculate the OIBD, or operating income before depreciation. Depreciation expense is significantly lower in fiscal 17 because there was a one-time adjustment in fiscal 16. The $18.3 million that you see in 17 is the normal number that we would expect to see going forward. Non-operating income was about $9 million lower in fiscal 17 because of a one-time lease restructuring fee that we received from a tenant in Rivergate in fiscal 16. And the net result of all these items is a net income of $32.6 million for the general fund, which is the best result for the general fund in the last decade. So on the bottom half of the slide, we have the high-level balance sheet information for the general fund. Again, you can see that both assets and liabilities increased during the year, but that the assets increased by about $42 million more and resulted in an increase to the general fund's net position. Like at PDX, this increase is mainly due to net income and capital grants received. So now we'll move on to the report on federal awards. The first portion of the report has much of the same information that's contained in the report on audited financial statements, but the additional focus of this report is on federal funding and the testing of internal control over financial reporting and compliance. So this slide recaps some of the information that starts on page 41 of that report regarding expenditures of federal awards. So you can see that our federal awards are pretty consistent from fiscal 16 to fiscal 17. Under the details heading, there are three lines that show the primary areas where we received federal funding and how much was expended under each program. Variances in grant funding are largely a function of the projects that the port's undertaking in a given year and their eligibility for funding. The Federal Aviation Administration Airport Improvement Program that funded airport capital improvements, and you can see we incurred slightly less eligible spending in fiscal 17 than in the prior year. The modest Homeland Security Transportation Security Administration grants that we receive help fund law enforcement and canine programs at PDX. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers dredging is our reimbursable contract for maintenance dredging of the river channel. While it's not technically a grant, it is considered a federal award for purposes of the reporting. And you can see we performed about $2 million more in maintenance dredging at the Corps' direction in fiscal 17. So I'll note here that Moss Adams had a compliance finding as part of this audit. Under the Army Corps contract, we are required to obtain a certification from certain subcontractors that states that they are not on the federal government's suspended and debarred list. The port did not have an adequate process in place to ensure that this happened. We revised the port's standard contract language and the template to ensure that the appropriate language is included and that we obtain the required certification going forward. And Moss Adams can tell you more about that during their presentation as well. So the last report that we've given you is the report on passenger facility charges. We generally refer to those as PFCs, and that's that $4.50 per ticket charge that's assessed on in-plane passengers collected by the airlines and remitted to the airport to be spent on FAA-approved projects. Again, the PFC report starts with much of the same information that is in the report on audited financial statements, but starting on page 41 of the report, information specific to the PFC program is included, as is Moss Adams' report on compliance and internal control over compliance related to the FAA's PFC program. So the table on this slide, you can see on the first line that PDX collected about $2.5 million more in PFCs in fiscal 17 than 16 as a result of those record implementments. We earned a little more interest on PFC balances in fiscal 17 as a result of higher cash balances and those slightly higher interest rates. And our spending was relatively flat from one year to the next. The spending is primarily for debt service in these 2 years on outstanding PFC revenue bonds that funded eligible capital projects in the past at the airport. And we plan to see increased PFC expenditures going forward, assuming that we receive approval from the FAA to spend PFCs on the terminal balancing project. So that concludes my review of the three audit reports that we've presented to you. Before I hand the microphone over to Moss Adams, I'll ask if there are any questions. And hearing none. You may recall back in May that you approved a new 5-year contract with Moss Adams to conduct an independent audit of the port's financial records. Though this is only the first audit under the new contract, I'm pleased to report that Moss Adams did an excellent job on getting up to speed on the port. They performed their audits in a way to minimize impacts on staff, and they issued timely reports. And they didn't know I was going to say this. With us here today to present their report and required communications are Jim Lanzarotta, the engagement partner, and Ashley Austin, the senior manager on the port audit. So come on up.
Thank
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, President Carter and members of the commission, we are very excited to be here and to be in a position to do the port's audit. As Moss Adams has built our government practice, we've been very selective in the types of entities that we want as clients to do that audit. And the port was identified early on as one of those. Our perception from the outside was a well-managed organization with some pretty bright people. And I'm let a little bit of a cat out of the bag before we get into our reports. That's pretty much what we found. Some pretty sharp folks here that very diligent and conscientious in the delivery of their services to the port. So a lot of our perceptions were confirmed in our work with the port. So we do have some slides, which I think were just given to you in a printed manner. So if you would turn to slide two of that. Our intent today is to walk you through the results of the audits, the different audits that Bob mentioned to you that we performed. And after we do that, we'd like to share with you a little bit more about the areas that we spent our time and our focus. And I'm going to ask Ashley to walk through some of the required communications that auditors have with auditees. And then there are some new accounting standards, which we won't go into in detail, but a couple comments about some of the upcoming accounting standards that the port will need to implement. So if you turn to that third page, so when we perform an audit of the port, you know, Bob did a good job of talking about all these different phases to this. I would say there's probably seven phases to our audit of the Port of Portland. The first three phases are related to the financial statements. So the blue report, as Bob referred to it, if you turn to that fourth page, the first three phases, you know, some of these I think you have a pretty good understanding of. An external audit of financial statements requires that independent verification of balances that are reflected as of year end, but also the numbers that run through your income statement equivalent, a statement of revenues and expenses, to make sure that approved transactions are reflected in there correctly. And we do that by looking at source documents, by communicating directly with your banks and custodians of the port's funds, working with internal and external legal counsel. So there's a lot of detailed testing of information that supports the numbers. So you have a pretty good understanding that that's what an audit is about. A second phase that may be not as obvious is a requirement that we look at your internal controls. So what are those checks and balances that management uses to make sure that they're capturing accurate information and can put together this annual financial statement correctly? And we have an obligation to report to you whether there are weaknesses in those controls. A third phase, I would say, is just a technical review of this financial statement. So you're pretty fortunate. There's about, I don't know, 1,500 to 1,700 entities, I think, that file financial statements with the state of Oregon. And a majority of those do not have the technical competence on staff to be able to put this document together according to all the rules that govern governmental financial statements. You have a crew that obviously are very experienced and have the expertise necessary to put this together. So our contribution was a review of that document, obviously making sure the numbers agree to what we audited, but to make sure that this document does in fact follow the applicable governmental accounting rules. So there's the first three phases. On slide five would be the fourth phase of our audit. So Bob mentioned, because you receive federal funding, you have an obligation to get an additional audit performed on your compliance with those particular federal grants that you receive. So we have an obligation to do the testing to determine if in fact you are complying with those requirements. But we also look to make sure you have internal controls again that help you, the checks and balances that help your staff meeting the compliance requirements of those grants. Now, Bob did mention that there was one finding there, and that does deal with the procurement. So you have an obligation to make sure that those vendors that you contract with are not on that suspended or debarred list. And there's certification generally obtained from vendors with regard to the core contract, that process was not occurring, at least the certifications were not being obtained. We did not identify any vendors that were on the list in the result of our testing, so it's more of a control process that will need to be improved. The fifth phase, if you go to page 6, would be the passenger facility charge audit. So because you take advantage of that program, like a lot of airports, there is a set of compliance requirements about how you collect, administer, and spend those dollars on approved programs. Your auditor has an obligation to test your compliance and do reporting on that, and again, to determine if you have those internal controls or checks and balances. And we're pleased to report that there were no control findings and no evidences of non-compliance with those particular requirements. A sixth phase, since you're an Oregon Municipal Corporation, the State of Oregon, the Audits Division, requires that auditors look to and do some testing over your compliance with certain Oregon revised statutes. So there's 6 or 7 areas that we're required to test. 2 take a majority of that time. 1 is your whole budget process. So the public hearings that you hold and the process you go through to adopt the budget. And then after it's adopted, the whole process of administration of that budget. A lot of state laws that you're required to abide by, so we test that. Another area that gets a lot of attention is procurement, again. So there's a set of statutes that govern how you procure services and goods. And as well, you have your own contract review board, which gives you a little more flexibility. But that comes with a set of policies, too, that we're required to test. So in our report, we identified only 1 instance of noncompliance. So you had an over expenditure compared to your approved budget for one of the departments here at the port. So that was 1 finding. And then the 7th phase, I would say, is just the reporting, what we're doing today, coming before you and talking about the results of the audit. I guess going back to page 4, one thing I skipped over on the financial statements, a very important element, is that we did, all as a result of all that work on your financials, came to what we technically call an unmodified opinion. So in layman's terms, that we would say that's a clean opinion. So we did all the work and we were able to verify that this financial statement document, in fact, carries the correct balances at year end and correctly reflects the results of the activity during the year, and further that this document has the required elements that the accounting standards applicable to government suggest would be necessary in your financial statements. So on slide 9, just gives you an idea of where we focused our efforts. So with a port, of course, in our first year, we're very interested in that internal control environment and making sure that we put our files together. We have good documentation of all those checks and balances that management uses. And you can see the different areas there where we were ensuring that we were understanding, obtaining an understanding, and documenting, and actually doing some testing of the effectiveness of those internal controls. With the port especially, and just about any government, but the port especially, there's a number of estimates inherent in your financial statements, especially on the liability side of your balance sheet. So environmental remediation is a big one and an area of focus and concern for you, I'm sure. Legal contingencies, you know, allowance for doubtful accounts. There's a number of areas that there's estimates. Depreciation, the how you expense the cost of your capital assets over their estimated lives. Anytime there's estimates, there's a area of emphasis for auditors and to make sure there isn't a particular bias of management and how they approach those estimates and calculations, and making sure there's consistency in how you are performing those calculations. The net pension liability is a real bugaboo for you, Oregon PERS. It's a nice benefit for your employees. The accounting side of it is very complicated and has turned out to be very turbulent, shall we say, in the numbers that run through here. Your contributions are fairly constant. You know what those are. They're set every 2 years. You can kind of predict the impact on you of those, but the accounting rules are complicated now. So as Oregon PERS experiences different levels of underfunding. You get to park your portion of that unfunded liability on your balance sheet. And as you'll see, if you saw some trends from Bob, that number has been extremely variable for you. And the level of expense that you run through your financial statements, this non-cash item that Bob mentioned, is highly variable, or has turned out to be that. But that's an area of emphasis for us. All the bond, so obviously a big part of your financing strategy here is to use bonded debt. That comes with compliance requirements and scrutiny from investors and third parties. So that gets a lot of attention from our standpoint as well. Revenue recognition, net position on page 10. IT, so we had a group of specialists within Moss Adams that came in and really kicked the tires on your IT systems, looking for risks. Security risks, appropriate roles of port staff, and so forth. The single audit we talked about, we always try to do a little unpredictable procedure in there each year. And of course, we're brand new to you, so almost everything we did might, you could say, was a little unpredictable. But within that, we tried to do something that was a little unique. So that gives you kind of a flavor of some of the areas that we focused our time and effort. So with that, I'd like to ask Ashley to kind of walk us through some of the required communications.
Thanks, Jim. Good morning.
Morning.
So if you move to slide 12, we'll begin our required communications. And these are communications that we are required to go over with you, those charged with governance, every single year. They don't change, so they can get a little bit on the boring side, but they are required, so I will communicate them. Our responsibility under U.S. Generally Accepted Auditing Standards and Government Auditing Standards is to express our opinion. The only thing that belongs to Moss Adams in that blue book that Bob mentioned is our opinion. Everything else is management's. And we're required to determine if they're fairly presented in accordance with Generally Accepted Accounting Principles. We perform our audit in accordance with Generally Accepted Auditing Standards and Government Auditing Standards, because you receive federal funds, to determine whether we have obtained reasonable rather than absolute assurance. So what that means is that we don't audit every dollar, and management thanks us for that. We do consider internal control, as Jim mentioned, but we don't opine on it. So we just use that for our testing procedures to see if we if management has internal controls in place. And then we communicate findings that, in our judgment, would be significant to you as a body that governs the organization. On slide 13, the plan, scope, and timing of the audit, we did discuss this with the commission officers back in June, and we didn't deviate from the plan, so nothing to report there. On to slide 14, significant accounting policies and unusual transactions. As you know, the port discloses the significant accounting policies in a footnote to the financial statements. We look at those significant accounting policies as part of our audit procedures, review any changes to those policies, and determine if they've implemented things correctly. There were no items that we reviewed during the year that had changed significantly from the prior year, and everything that we looked at was reasonable. Management judgments, as Jim mentioned, the financial statements include a lot of management judgment and estimates. We look at those to determine if they have any management bias, and we determined that there was no bias in any of those estimates, and they were recorded reasonably. In terms of the disclosures to the financial statements, we like to call out certain disclosures that are sensitive to the organization. And I mentioned the summary of significant accounting policies in footnote one. Also, clearly your long-term debt, since you do rely on a lot of bonded debt, as Jim mentioned, the pension plans and deferred compensation in note eight, the post-employment health care benefits in note nine, and then of course your commitments and contingencies, which includes all that environmental remediation liability discussion. On slide 17, you know, we are required to communicate if there were any significant difficulties. That would be something if management wasn't providing us access with the people that we wanted to talk to, if they weren't providing us documents that we wanted to see. None of that happened, so there were no disagreements with management this year. Significant audit adjustments and unadjusted differences. So this is talking about any audit adjustments that we identify that must be posted to the financial statements to make them fairly stated in accordance with GAAP, or unadjusted accounting adjustments that really are just things that are proposed by us that management passes on adjusting in the financial statements. No uncorrected audit adjustments this year. But we did propose, and management did elect to record a reclass between land held for resale and construction in progress, totaling about $36 million. They also adjusted the prior year for about $23 million. And that just came as a result of our testing that we did over capital assets and identified that there were some costs in land held for sale that really should be in construction in progress. On to slide 19. As you know, the port is subject to legal proceedings and claims. Those are all disclosed in the financial statements. We look at those. We obtain a lot of attorney representation letters from all of the outside attorneys, as well as your general counsel. We review those and make sure that they are disclosed appropriately. And then slide 20, no disagreements with management. This is something that if we disagreed over an accounting policy or an accounting treatment, something like that, that we would be disclosing that to you. There were no such things this year. Slide 21, we've already talked a lot about the significant deficiency over the single audit, the procurement. So I won't talk about that anymore, but there were no material weaknesses identified, just one significant deficiency over the single audit. So pretty clean audit this year. No other things to bring to your attention. Slide 22, management's consultation with other accountants. This, we would be required to report whether or not management had gone out and asked another auditor for a second opinion on a set of facts and circumstances. Our standards require that that auditor would have to come and ask us to make sure that they had all of the relevant facts and circumstances. None of those consultations occurred during the year two that we're aware of. Other material written communications, you know, other than the contract that we signed this year, the management rep letter that we obtained before we issue the financial statements and our report and final, and a small management letter that discusses some small best practice recommendations, there were no other significant communications, and you can request the rep letter and the management letter from Bob. Slide 24 discusses going concern. As Bob mentioned, the port had a very great year. We are required to consider whether or not the port can continue for the next year, the next 12 months. Clearly, there were no problems this year, and we would definitely be discussing that with you earlier than this meeting if there were concerns. Fraud and noncompliance, we didn't become aware of any instances of fraud or noncompliance with laws and regulations during our audit procedures. And that's really our required communications in a nutshell. So were there any questions on that specific piece?
Okay. Yeah, I might just clarify too, the reclass adjustment that Ashley went over on that page 18 is really just geography of where certain costs get reported on the face of your balance sheet. That's not an indication of, you know, an error in any of that other than just where, you know, land held for sale is a very particular type of asset for you. Your intention is to develop it, sell it, whereas capital assets are those things you use to provide services. So the runways, the buildings, so forth. So geography of where numbers get reflected is important to make sure we're being pretty transparent about where those things, what type of asset we hold. And so really that's just geography of where the costs of some of the land that was in development stage, where those get reflected on the face of the statements. In terms of the, again, this is, we don't want to go over all these new accounting standards. There's just a couple that will have an impact on the port. And perhaps maybe the biggest thing I could say about this is there are a number of new accounting standards coming at us, and you've been supportive, I think, of your finance staff in getting the training and education on these. And of course, we would like to in support of your support to ensure that that continues to happen. We're pretty impressed of the knowledge level of your finance staff, of their knowledge of these things, and we will do our part to work with them as it comes time to implement these. Probably the one that has my attention on behalf of the port the most would be the standard on leases on page 32. So, and fortunately, we have a fair amount of time to prepare for that. As you know, a big part of the port's activity is in leasing. So you're a lessor, you're a lessee to a small extent, but lessor, a lot of the tenants here, and this will have a big impact on how lease accounting will happen and how numbers will be reflected in your financial statements. And I suspect in your case, it's probably going to require a software solution. I don't think this is something that your accounting staff are going to be able to do in Excel schedules very effectively. So that's one to really stay on top of, and I know that your staff's already well aware of that, and we'll certainly help them with the implementation of that. So that's probably of all of these the one that has my attention on your behalf more so than the others. So with that, again, just would open it up for questions, and again, just express our appreciation for being selected in your competitive bid process. You know, we built our practice, and it's nice to see affirmation that in your process you determined that we were the best fit for you. And it's also been great for us to see that our perception of what we were going to find here really is the what we found. Some really good people to work with. Appreciated our time to chat. So as you take the helm, and I think you're in good hands. Sorry to see that you might not be hanging around for too much longer. That's sad, but also an opportunity maybe for someone else.
Yes.
Anyway.
So any comments, questions?
No.
Go ahead, Alice.
Thank you for a thorough presentation. You answered my reclassification question.
Yeah.
The other one I had was on the overexpenditure. Mm-hmm. It isn't presented as a deficiency on internal control. So I'm wondering if you just didn't think that it was an internal control issue that gave rise to that.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, you could, and sometimes we do identify that or call it out. In terms of our findings with our government clients, that is the most common finding. And what tends to happen is it at year end, as you're accruing the expenses that occurred, so you haven't cut the check yet, it's often that one will surprise our clients. So they do a pretty good job of managing the cash that runs through, but because you're not budgeting completely on a cash basis, some of those bills that come in the final month or the final weeks, oftentimes these don't come in until after year end. And so managing that becomes a challenge. So we don't always call it out as a deficiency. Just to give you a flavor of it, the total expenditure budget for your general fund was almost $213 million. The over expenditure was $97,000. So it's on page 46 of the financial statements is that budgetary compare. So to put it in perspective, pretty small dollars on a fund that has a pretty large budget. So given that we didn't, now for some of our clients where we see a department that year after year has this issue, or if it's more endemic throughout, now this is just one department within all of your departments that had that over expenditure, then we probably would have been a little more aggressive in our reporting. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Tom?
Yeah, I thank you very much. I have two very quick questions, none of which is either substantive or very technical. On slide 21, you know, one of that very, what you term as significant deficiency, is it part of your legal or professional responsibility to keep track of, these items with the management during the next year or whatever, see how that is being addressed?
Yes, we will report whether or not it was resolved, and it will be a part of your financial reporting package for the single
audit. Next year or during the year?
Next year.
Next year,
we will look at it to see if it's been resolved, and then we'll report on it.
Okay.
It's included in the single audit reporting package, and you'll see that there was a prior year finding in the...
Fun?
Yeah. Blue book?
It's not the blue book.
No, it says federal awards.
Okay. Federal awards. There was a prior year finding identified in the by the prior auditors, which was resolved in the current year, and it was reported on in that report.
Okay, I have not read that yet. Thank you. And one more quick one is this is slide 26. This picture, what does this signify? I'm just curious. Is that you're saying that the bird's eye view of this whole thing that we do here, or what? It's because you know, area of view.
Actually, I think these photos really have nothing to do with the port. So Moss Adams just went through a rebranding. And Find Your West, not to be a geographic necessarily concept, but these photographs were selected by our marketing department to help illustrate this brand of Finding Your West. And I don't know if I can eloquently explain all of the marketing decisions behind these different photographs, which is probably a bad part or saying something about me that I'm not far enough down the path on our new branding.
I was just curious. That's why I said it was nothing technical, but it got my attention.
It's just a very pretty picture, right?
Mike.
Thank you.
Let me also thank you for a very thorough presentation. I had one question, and this was regarding the finding on the weakness of control regarding procurement and suspension of contractors. This is your first audit experience, but had that been a control that was tested for previously, or do you have any way of knowing whether the prior audit had sort of identified that as a...
Well, we've reviewed the prior year auditor work papers as part of our process, and we did not identify that they had identified it as a deficiency. Okay. But we would assume that it had been tested previously.
Okay. But that might be a question that Bob Burkett could answer, since he's still here.
It was a different contract in the past. So this was a one-year bridge contract that they were looking at, and it had a specific federal acquisition register reference in there.
Yeah, actually, I could elaborate on that. That's a good point. One of the things is that you saw that I think Bob presented you a slide that showed three different federal grants. I mean, in any one year, you could have a number of grants. Your two largest ones tend to be Federal Aviation Administration grants and the Corps. And the rules that govern how we perform our single audit or that grant audit tells us that we cycle. You don't have to audit the same program year after year. So that FAA grant had been singled out and audited in the prior year, and this particular issue was not identified at. So they did in fact test for this. And I think for your FAA grant and the administration of that, you do have processes in place to look for procurement. So they did test it. I believe we found evidence they tested it. They didn't find an issue. We looked at the core contract this year. So through that cycling process, that was the one selected as the major program to look at. With that particular grant and the administration of it, the port did not have an appropriate control in place dealing with that suspension and debarment requirement.
Thank you.
Anything else?
I just comment, very good audit report. Thank you, Moss Adams, and thank you to the accounting team here, because it takes a lot of work to get this good of a report.
And I think, given that this is your first year, it's great for us to hear that it's a clean report and positive report. And I'm assuming that it's one that you think is most important to do very well, since it's your first one, and you don't want to look back and think you missed something. So thanks for that.
Yeah.
And the report.
Yeah, thank you. It is interesting. We go through this, and the part where we talk about the unmodified opinion on the financials gets just a few seconds, but you're right. The level of effort by your staff to get there, and it deserves, there should be balloons or confetti or something. It really is a tremendous process, and we are just pleased to find what we had hoped to find, which is some very conscientious individuals that that work hard to make sure that you put this document together. So in any event, we've been very pleased with our first year. There's always some snags and issues to work through, and so we'll work with your staff to make it even a smoother process. But this has been really great for us, and really appreciate what we have found here at the port.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you two go.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have one additional, before we move on here, one additional request for public comment, and that's from Catherine Lamb. So we're going to do that now before we go on to the next item. And Catherine, if you'd introduce yourself and then explain your comment. So,
good morning, Commissioner. My name is Catherine with Bambooza, and I just want to clarify that the LIPA piece with United here with the intent to not to strike or lock out the employee, but also to guarantee the passenger experience. We don't want to disrupt any experience if that's the case. And I like to share with you, due to the RFP awarded in first round in 2014, our company have now been able to offer not just the healthcare benefits to our staff, but also other benefits that I like to share with the commissioner. The employee parking and badging, we pay 100%, employee meal or uniform. And we also have Employee of the Month program or Employee of the Year program. And we also have referral bonus program that in addition to what we require by law to provide for our staff. And I have provide a little bit of data stating our employee, how much they get per hour. Including tips and their wage. In the past, since the minimum wage raise, their hourly rate above $15 an hour on average. I have this available if you are interested in seeing it. And I just want to, again, on behalf of our company and our staff, would like to appreciate the opportunity for small businesses, local business like us. Definitely, it's open a new chapter for our company, and we now employed about 80 families with our company, and we just want to appreciate the opportunity for being here and being a partner with the port. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And as I said to Stefan earlier, we are taking a deeper look from all our stakeholders' perspective with regard to concessions, and we'll be working with that over the next few months, and there'll be some more public comment on that. So thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Catherine.
So Lisa, you're next up here. Thanks for waiting. This is a first agenda item on ordinance 463-CP.
Good morning. I'm Lisa Fedeli, Director of Financial Planning and Analysis. I am here today to review the recommendation for a new airport commercial paper or CP program for PDX. I will review the actions requiring approval, then talk about what CP is, how it is proposed to be used, how it works, and then what steps are required to enact the proposed ordinance. The approval of Ordinance 463-CP would authorize the sale of up to $300 million at any one time of airport CP notes to fund capital projects in the port and airline cost centers. What is CP? So CP is a promissory note issued at short-term variable interest rates. CP is a financing instrument that's been around since the late 1800s, and there's tens of billions of dollars outstanding in the marketplace. Mutual funds are the primary investors in CP, and maturities can range from 1 to 270 days, although 30, 60, or 90 days are most common. So why have a CP program? The CP program will provide interim funding for PDX's capital needs, which will be issued on a just-in-time basis to pay capital expenditures. The outstanding notes will be refunded with long-term bonds in a future fiscal year, and using CP in the interim reduces the amount of capitalized interest needed when we do issue that long-term debt. Having a CP program also provides flexibility around when we would need to issue long-term bonds, and once the CP is repaid, the program can then be used for another set of PDX projects. As is always the case, a request to approve an ordinance authorizing this issuance of future long-term debt would come to commission for approval prior to any long-term debt being sold. So the projects to be financed, initially the commercial paper will be used to fund the early work packages for the parking additions and consolidated rental car facility or Packer project that came to commission last month. It is also intended to fund the Terminal Core project, which includes Concourse B improvements and the demolition of Concourse A, as well as other various terminal and airfield projects that will eventually be financed with long-term bonds. So let me talk to you about how CP works. So the Port of Portland is issuer of the notes. There are three banks involved in the program, and they each play a different role. Barclays is the letter of credit provider, and the notes are backed by this letter of credit. The dealer is Citibank, and they sell the notes to investors. U.S. Bank is the issuing and paying agent, and they act like a trustee, and they move the money to the correct recipients. So, for example, on a note's maturity date, U.S. Bank, as issuing and paying agent, will draw on the letter of credit. Barclays then provides those funds, and they're used to pay off the investor. Citi, as dealer, then sells a new note to an investor, and those funds from the new investor go back to Barclays to repay the draw on the letter of credit. So because the letter of credit banks pays off maturing notes directly and is highly rated with large capital reserves, there's very little risk to the port with this program. So there's specific items that need to be done for approval of an ordinance, so I'll read them. It's the executive director's recommendation that Ordinance 463 CP in the form presented to the commission be read by title only, and that a public hearing be held prior to enacting Ordinance 463 CP, that the proposed Ordinance 463 CP in the form presented to the commission be enacted by a roll call vote, and that the executive director or his designee is authorized to execute the necessary documents on the behalf of commission in the form approved by council. Are there any questions?
Yeah, so before we open this as a public hearing, I guess we'll have commission questions if there are any. Tom?
Oh, sorry,
Linda.
My question is, what's the fee? Is it covered by a spread between LIBOR and what
on
you charge?
The interest rate on the notes or the fee on the letter of credit? So the interest rate, it will be market rates when Citi sells it. So it's whatever commercial paper is going for. We just had pulled some rates, and they were just a little over 1%. We do pay a percentage for the letter of credit, and so they bid that out, and that would be 40 basis points on the letter of credit, which is 0.47%. And then we pay a fee to the dealer as well, which was very small. It was 4 basis points, which is 0.04%. I feel like they're practically working for free. And then we pay a set fee for the issuing and paying agent per year, which was $3,000.
Tom.
Yeah, thank you. My question was also very similar to her, so she's already gotten 90% of the answers for me. 10%. Usually, CPs are a little lower in terms of interest rate than the bond.
Right.
What is the spread? What is the difference nowadays, customarily speaking?
Well, for example, the series...
Talk about the 1%, right? Just about.
Right.
Then how much would the long-term bonds might be?
Well, we were in the market with the Series 24 in January, and that came in at 4%.
Four.
And then...
spread is pretty significant there.
Yes, and because we would be issuing the long-term debt while the closer to the placed in service date, those are less bonds that we have to issue to pay interest between the debt issuance and the placed in service date. So they'll be, we have a savings there as well.
Mm. That's all I need to know. Thanks so much.
So just in simple terms, the reason we're doing this now is that we think we will save money on the money that we borrow if we use this vehicle. That's one reason?
That's one reason, yes.
Another reason is that we anticipate that longer-term interest rates are not going to change so fast, that this short-term debt vehicle is not going to cost us more money than the longer-term issuance of bonds.
I don't think that interest rates are necessarily going to go down. They would most likely go up. So if we thought interest rates were going to go down, then maybe this wouldn't be such a good bargain. But interest rates have been low for so long, there's not much more downward movement that the market, experts in the market predict could happen.
And does this enable us to expand our ability to issue debt?
We would issue the same amount of we'd issue long-term bonds for the same projects. I don't know if that answers your question. This wouldn't mean that we would finance more projects than we otherwise would.
That's my question.
Yeah, no, we would. It's the same list of projects, which is mostly, we've looked ahead. We're in discussions with Standard & Poor's right now regarding the commercial paper program, and they've asked for our CIP. And it's really the terminal core, the Packer project, and then a few miscellaneous terminal projects that are somewhat big for cash reasons. There's a $10 million hot water pipe. There's just various Wi-Fi improvements that I would fold into here that are just a little large when you combine them to use cash. And so that's the same set, whether I issued long-term debt for them or a CP and then long-term debt.
Okay.
I think one analogy that we've discussed, that a CP is really, if you're thinking about your own ability to purchase something, it's another arrow in your quiver, right? It's a different style. You still have the same amount available to you, but it provides you another tool. These are shorter term. You said the average is 60 to 90. Right. And there tend to be lower rates, in part because you're not locking in a longer term loan. So you can take advantage of some of these market differentials, but also enables a little flex on these projects that eventually we're going to have to go out and.
Right. And it provides us a lot of flexibility in when we would need to enter the long-term market. So if there was some event that where the market was disrupted, commercial paper gives us that ability to continue our program before being rushed into the market at a time that we're, may not be the best time to get in due to outside market influences.
So I'm kind of looking at this as it's a quick access to available funds, not quite as good as cash, because that means you have the money in the bank to pay for this.
Right.
But it's an acceptable vehicle that's used by many entities like us.
Yes. And there's a lot of airports that have commercial paper programs in particular.
Okay. Any other questions? I now would ask you to read the ordinance by title only, Lisa, and then we'll open the public hearing.
Okay. Bear with me here. It's an ordinance authorizing the issuance of commercial paper notes in an aggregate amount not to exceed $300 million outstanding at any one time to pay, refinance, or reimburse the port for the payment of the cost of constructing, renovating, acquiring, equipping, and installing improvements at the Portland International Airport, and to pay costs related thereto, and to pay costs of issuing the commercial paper notes, including to pay principal of and interest to accrue on all or a portion of the commercial paper notes, delegating to the executive director authorization to establish terms and conditions for the issuance and payment of said commercial paper notes, and to take other necessary actions in connection therewith, authorizing amendments to the Port's Airport Revenue Bond Ordinance number 155 as amended and Airport Revenue Bond Ordinance number 323 as amended, authorized and providing for related matters and documents.
Thank you. So this is a public hearing that will open now on ordinance number 463-CP. And does any member of the public wish to be heard? Not seeing any raised hands or volunteers to delve into this complicated area. Close the public hearing and ask for a motion and second to adopt the resolution. We have to do this by roll call. So, Pam.
We need a motion and a second first.
After we have a motion and second, we'll do it by recall.
Second.
Okay.
Commissioners Alexander?
Aye.
Carter?
Yes.
Chamberlain?
Yes.
Kuprokomis?
Yes.
Levy?
Yes.
McDonald?
Yes.
Pierce?
Yes.
Saruta?
Yes.
And Young?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Motion carries. Vince?
Bring another chair. We've got some multiples coming up here. So
we have a draft.
So good morning. This first item that I've gotten within my group here is a request to approve an operating and use agreement for a distributed antenna system here at PDX. This will do a couple of different things for us, primarily around customer service, but also safety and security, where it'll expand our cellular coverage throughout the building, but it'll also upgrade some of our radios to be more in line with the City of Portland's system. So it's a complicated system, and what we've ended up doing is a concession on this. rather than just an expense contract. So we have Michelle Campbell from our business and properties group, and then we also have Dave Blitzer from our IT group to talk about this program. So I'll let you guys take it from here.
Thank you, Vince. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Before we begin, we do have a few folks that are in the audience that I'd like to acknowledge from Boyangle Wireless. We have Patrick Magnarelli. He's in business development. And we have Marco Learmont, account manager. Brian Churchman, the DAS program manager. And Saif Albasam, the DAS principal engineer. I'd like to thank them for joining us today. So as Vince mentioned, today we are here requesting approval to move forward and enter into an operating and use agreement with Boyangle Wireless Incorporated. It's a very technical project, and I'll hand it over to Dave to talk a little bit more about what a distributed antenna system is.
All right, good morning. I'm going to try to keep this as interesting as possible. Thanks for the opportunity.
Commercial paper.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. That setup.
I think it'll be very interesting.
And I really appreciate the opportunity to address the commission. Currently, when you make a cell phone call from the airport, your phone connects to antennas on the short-term parking garage or on cell towers like on Marine Drive and Columbia Boulevard. This creates uneven coverage and dead spots in areas like pedestrian tunnels and lower levels of the terminal and concourses. The same is true for the port public safety radio system. A distributed antenna system, or DAS, seeks to deliver consistent indoor cellular and public safety coverage via a network of antennas installed in the ceiling. This permits us to direct wireless service into the exact areas we need to and reduce and eliminate dead spots. Additionally, the existing towers that we use right now surrounding the airport will have difficulty delivering the next generation of high-speed data, aka 5G, inside the airport. DAS achieves this by bringing these antennas inside, allowing for future expansion. Overall, this results in increased safety for our passengers and employees, as well as faster download speeds and better call quality, which increases the overall passenger experience at PDX. Just want to give you some brief background on the history of DAS at PDX.
Go ahead, just make sure you're in the mic.
Sure. We do have an existing DAS system. It was installed in 2010. It's limited to a few areas. System carries AT&T cellular service and public safety radio to just a handful of spots throughout the terminal and concourses A and C. This system was studied in 2015 during the Airport Technology Master Plan development process, which identified several issues with the existing system, including minimal expansion capability, limited support for additional carriers, outdated equipment. So this plan recommended the upgrade and or expansion of the DAS and prioritized this project as very high. In 2016, the City of Portland upgraded the public safety radio system at PDX. DAS upgrades will be necessary to interface with this new city system and ensure we meet the city specifications for emergency responder radio coverage. And finally, over the past few years, the port has received numerous formal and informal requests by wireless carriers such as Verizon and AT&T to install DAS equipment at the airport. This is a diagram of a typical DAS system. The head end houses the brains of the system and connections to wireless carriers in the city. Fiber optic cables run from the head end to various antenna locations throughout the airport. And then antennas are really the only part of the system that is visible to the public. It's a single antenna, similar to like a wireless access point, where there's one back there on the soffit. This configuration reduces the impact on the facility by allowing multiple carriers to share the same antennas instead of separate antennas for each carrier. It also allows carriers to upgrade technologies and join and leave the system with minimal impact or infrastructure changes. We did an RFP for vendors to implement this system, and I just want to talk to you a little bit about the goals for that RFP. It had a number of goals, including the requirement of a neutral host system. There are a number of advantages to neutral host. Number one, it's third-party investment. So it shifts the capital build-out costs and the operation and maintenance costs away from the port to a firm that specializes in this type of wireless work. and while generating revenue for the port. DAS are quickly becoming critical in-building systems that require 24/7 uptime to ensure public safety and passenger experience are maintained. A system of this magnitude is very resource-intensive to operate and monitor. Additional port IT staff and expenditures would be necessary to maintain the rigorous uptime requirements the system calls for, so a neutral host vendor handles all aspects of this system, including 24/7 monitoring, reducing the impact to port IT resources. I'm now going to turn it over to Michelle to discuss the coverage areas of the system and the key business terms of the agreement. Thanks.
So you'll see here on this graphic the areas that were considered required coverage areas, and we listed them through in the RFP for both cellular and public safety. In the terminal, we looked for the tunnel, the in-planing, deplaning, as well as the mezzanine levels to be covered, both the north and south pedestrian tunnels, the short-term and the long-term parking garage, as well as all floors of the headquarters building for the port. We also, the port identified six outlying buildings that were listed in the RFP as optional as well. So we issued the RFP in February of this year, and we received 9 proposals that were reviewed and scored by a 7-member evaluation team. We also had an aviation technology consultant, as well as additional port IT staff, take a look at the proposals and review them as well. Based on the criteria that you see up here on the screen, the evaluation team made the decision to select Boingo Wireless Incorporated as a successful proposer. Boingo operates neutral host DAS and or Wi-Fi networks in more than 30 airports, to include Chicago O'Hare, JFK, and Newark. For the DAS system specifically, they have 37 live and 81 pending systems. They average 3.4 carriers to come onto a system over a 3-year period live, and they have 99.5% uptime. And the design, project management, operations, the 24/7 operations, the carrier relations, account management, and the call center support is all handled in-house. Moving on to the business terms, the initial length of term will be 10 years. It will commence when the system is fully operational with one wireless service provider on board. We also have an additional 5-year optional term that will be agreed upon by both parties. For the rent is a one-time payment to the port for each wireless service provider that comes onto the system. The first one is a $900,000, the second is $800,000, the third is $500,000, the fourth is $300,000. So if all 4 carriers come on board for the initial 10-year term, the port will receive $2.5 million. The optional term, the 5-year optional term, will be negotiated prior to commencement in regards to rent. As Dave mentioned earlier, the capital investment is shifted to the operator. Boingo estimates that their initial capital investment will be a little bit over $7 million for both the cellular and the public safety systems. And small business, they've committed to 13% of the project installation cost to be small business. They have a prior working relationship with a local women-owned company named Aviation Business Technologies and plan to use them as part of this project. So, in final staff requests approval of the executive director's recommendation to enter into an operating and use agreement with Boingo Wireless Incorporated, the successful proposer to the 2017 concessions request for proposal for a distributed antenna system at Portland International Airport.
Questions?
Tom. Thank you very much. Usually, the requests such as this comes with the list of proposers and who they were. You talk about 9 of them applied. This one particularly just simply gives us the result of your, I guess, 7-member survey group. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between this and the usual? You talk about the proposed financial, I guess a proposal price or whatever you call the contract price. Oh, I'm looking for those, but that wasn't here. Do you understand what my question is?
I think so. Are you saying that we normally include in the written item the other proposers that were not successful?
Right.
And we didn't this time.
Oh, yeah. So I was curious, why is that?
Good question. I'm not sure why we did that. We can get that to you to find the other, who the folks that were unsuccessful. Do you happen to know any of them off just top of your head? Okay.
Crown Castle, Verizon, Insight, AT&T, SBC. I'm missing somebody.
No, it's okay.
That's about all I can remember right now.
For you to get verbally, it doesn't really mean that much, but usually you provide a little more information as to why, for example, is it that the best price proposer did not get the contract because of this and this and that. This is simply the consequence of what you did.
Mm-hmm. So, why we chose Boingo.
Sure. If we can go back to the evaluation criteria, that was part of the RFP. So you'll see that there's five categories that we evaluated all the proposals on. We put the most weight on the technical head-end solutions at 30%. The proposed revenue sharing was 20%. The qualifications project approach was 20%. The system operations was 20%, and small business was 10%. So we reviewed the proposals and scored them based on that. The technical side we saw as being the most important, the technical piece of the DAS, and that's how we came to the successful proposer.
So all of those things have been done. I'm just asking, going forward, give us a little more information.
Absolutely.
Except that what was decided.
So I'm, as a typical traveler, familiar with Boingo and how it operates, and typically you get a 60-minute free period and then you pay beyond that, depending on what kind of flight and layover time you have. So from a consumer's perspective for the airport, I mean, it probably is time that the airport charge, like other airports do, in a familiar fashion, but is that how this system will operate?
No.
Oh, so tell us more detail.
Boingo will only be maintaining and operating the DAS system. The Wi-Fi system is a separate system that we manage and maintain and operate internally at the port. So that's there will important. Be no fee for Wi-Fi.
Okay. And so that we control whether there's charge for local Wi-Fi.
Correct. Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Well, that ensures my yes vote because free Wi-Fi.
Especially if you have to stick around for too long.
Yeah. I do have a serious question, though.
Okay.
I see the in the scope of the contract, the small business participation program is targeted at 13% relative to the installation. Is there any targeted participation post-installation? What does that look like? Or has it been identified or ascribed to in some way?
It has not been identified at this time. They focused on the installation. Majority of what Boingo does is in-house. I'm not sure if there's possibilities for small business participation once the installation is up and running. The Aviation Business Technologies is also, it's my understanding that they will be part of project support. I'm not sure if that project support will continue after the installation is up and running.
Yeah, I would think that the opportunity is greatest in that initial stage, but it's a wonderful potential to sort of lock into that as something that would carry on throughout the life of the project, even if it's not at that higher level.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Go
ahead, Pat.
President Carter, thank you for your presentation. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the provisions for any technology advances over the next, since it's a 10-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
We can be assured that there will be changes, and I was wondering what accommodations and considerations.
Yeah, there are provisions in the operating agreement for continual upgrade and refresh of the system, and I think the really unique thing this system provides is it's a common backbone, and basically most of the changes occur in that head-end location, so your antennas stay. We're not constantly removing and changing antennas. We're essentially just changing equipment in a back room somewhere and using this common infrastructure year over year.
Would those, are those covered by the this current contract, mm-hmm. or would those incur additional fees?
So the upgrades, they are required to maintain, operate, upgrade throughout the 10 years. And then Boingo will also have the sub-agreements with the wireless carriers, which I believe also cover that too.
I think the funding for those upgrades would come from the carriers, typically.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. Is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
I so move.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thanks. Motion carries. And thanks for the presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is, Vince, you've got next the civil service.
Yes.
Firemen, firefighters.
Yes, we were here last month around the civil service ordinance amendment. This will allow us to, we believe, increase the diversity in the hiring process out at the fire station. So we're here for the second reading and process of that amendment.
Thank you.
Okay, so good morning to you all. As Vince stated, this is the second one, so I understand that I don't necessarily have to go through all the specific details that we just did last month. And instead, I can just give a summary on why this is important and why we want to do it. So therefore, I plan to be brief. So in summary, let me go ahead and move forward. This is important, is an important amendment because this will give us an opportunity to continue to build upon our equity and diversity culture here that we have at the Port of Portland. So that's number one. And the way we're going to go about doing that through this amendment is interviewing the highest ranking underrepresented individual on our eligibility list for firefighters, in addition to the three that are already part of our current practice. As I mentioned last month, today, we have our eligibility list. The top three are the ones that get the interview. What this amendment is going to do is be able to reach and get the underrepresented individual, the highest ranking on that list, allow them to be interviewed as well. So from three to now four interviews. What's important about the interview process is the fact that once you get to the interview, it's a level playing field. And whether you're going to actually walk through that door and get the job opportunity or not depends on your performance at that interview. Today, and most recently, in recent past, underrepresented individuals haven't had the opportunity to even see the door. This will give them that opportunity to do that. It does not guarantee that an underrepresented individual will get the job, but at least be able to see the door and get through the process. So I wanted to make those 2 points clear when we get to the interview and why that's important. Also, I want to address the last month when I was here, a few of you mentioned some long-term strategies that we might be able to think about going forward. I'm happy to report that since then, obviously, you all bring it up here, we're going to talk about it. We talked about it a little bit beforehand, but in addition, we've talked about some things like local recruiting at high schools, colleges. We've identified a lot of community, the camps that are here locally, as well as apprenticeships, internships, things like that. So I do want to report back that we have had those conversations. If anything, I think what's most important also here is this is going to be an opportunity for the Port of Portland Fire Department to reflect the community that it serves. Today, it doesn't necessarily look that way, but I know and we know that going forward, an amendment like this will help us get there. That is the summary on why this is important and exactly what it is that we're doing. So I'll go ahead and move to the language here. So the recommendation, this is the current language here that really just says we go through our eligibility process, we bring in the top three, those folks get interviewed, and then a job is offered. This is the proposed language, which states when there is a discrepancy found in our diversity, equity, so forth, we will add this language here. And that will only be when we do that. I also wanted to bring up the long-term strategy because our hope is that one day this additional language won't be necessary because we'll address it here short-term, but we'll also address it long-term as well, and this won't be necessary. This only comes in when there is a deficit. That's the proposal. That's the recommendation that we want to give to you all, and I believe we're going to vote on today. So thank you all for your time. Any questions?
If thank you. Any questions, comments? Okay, so, Chris, I need you to read the ordinance 462-R by title only, and then we'll move to approve it.
Yes, sir. Mine's not as long as Lisa's was, so... An ordinance amending and restating ordinance number 275 as amended by port ordinance number 300 as amended by ordinance number 425-R that established a civil service system for firefighters and created a civil service commission.
And is there a motion and second to adopt the ordinance?
Second.
All those in favor?
Nope. Aye.
Oh, it's a roll call. I'm sorry. You can't do it that way. We'll do the roll call.
Commissioners Alexander.
I want to take some personal liberty before I just say aye. Is that I'm impressed by this because the port has indicated that they are flexible about process without being flexible about outcome. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. Aye.
Carter.
Yes.
Chamberlain.
Yes.
Kuprel Comas. Yes. Levy.
Yes.
McDonald.
Yes.
Pierce.
Yes.
Saruta.
Yes.
And Young.
Yes.
So that motion carries, and it's been brought to my attention, I can see uniforms back there, that we have a number of people from the fire department here in support of this process, and thank them for their engagement as well. And Chris, you personally have done a great job, and so I'm assuming your superiors in the department or representatives of the department that you're representing have been helpful to you as well.
Very much so. Very much
so. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Yes, sir.
Next item.
Well, we're sticking with the fire department, and we're going to have the chief. We're going to have the chief of our airport fire department talk as well. We're here to replace a truck. We do these infrequently, but it's a long process that we go through to get these trucks. And so I thought it would be useful to have the chief talk about our program, what happens with the new trucks, where they go into the older trucks, and how we kind of surplus them through the process. And then we've got Tanya here talking a little about the design and the procurement process. So we'll let the chief talk about the whole acquisition.
All right. Well, thank you, Vince, and good morning to you all. It's a pleasure to speak with you this morning. So we are here to speak towards the replacement of ARFF apparatus truck 85. And request your approval for that. So first of all, what are we purchasing, and what is ARFF? That's just our acronym for aircraft rescue and firefighting, so you know what that means. So that really refers to our specialized fire trucks that are specific for the purpose of protecting aircraft. So we have to maintain three of these at Portland International Airport to maintain our index per the FAA, and that's really critical for us. If we drop below the number of trucks on the front line, then our index drops. We have a 24-hour time frame to repair that per the FAA regulations. And so to do that, we maintain a reserve stable of apparatus, because obviously frontline apparatus need to be turned into maintenance, and they break. And there can be other things that they're called to. So we have to maintain a backup stable. So a lot of this conversation is really about the reserve apparatus and not the front line. So we propose to purchase a 3,000-gallon aircraft rescue firefighting truck for first response. And this would relocate an existing ARFF truck that's on the front line now. This is truck 85, and I'll show you some pictures in a moment. It was constructed in 2005 to reserve status. But most importantly, what it does is it allows us to retire a vintage ARFF truck, this is 88, that was constructed in 1993. And the total cost of this project is estimated at $1,568,000, and that includes the equipment. And Tanya will speak more to that a little bit later. And we look at our key stakeholders here being clearly our passengers and airlines for the maintenance and safety of all that fly here. And we are partnered up with IT and maintenance in the procurement of this vehicle as well. The purchase is proposed to be through a cooperative purchasing agreement that is approved under port contracting rules, and our estimated delivery date is November of 2018 for this vehicle. It takes about a year to build one of these. They're very sophisticated apparatus. And so this is a picture of what we essentially be purchasing. This is our existing foam truck 86, and it's also a 3,000 gallon striker, as they're called. And the goal is to essentially bring a clone to this vehicle into the front line that's similar, similar controls, so that firefighters can train to one standard, much like pilots will, you know, they prefer in airlines often to have one airplane that they fly that has a standardized control. So that is what we are proposing to purchase. And the next slide will show, this is ARFF truck 85, and this is the apparatus that we would propose to move to reserve status and become the backup to our frontline apparatus. And then the next slide here will give you a picture of what we propose to retire. And this is a 1993 ARFF truck that would retire from the fleet in 2018 at the end of its service here. And so a little bit of the why this is important. So due to the scheduled maintenance and mechanical issues that I mentioned earlier before, our reserve trucks are in service on the front line over 50% of the time. So what that really means is those backup trucks are protecting aircraft here a high percentage of the time. Our current reserve trucks are 24 years old and 16 years old respectively. Failure to replace the frontline apparatus effectively leaves aged reserve apparatus protecting the airport when our front lines are out of service. So for the industry, on average, most ARFF vehicles stay on the front line about 10 to 12 years and then are moved to reserve status for an additional 10 to 12 years, as consistent with other airports and also with the NFPA standards, which is the National Fire Protection Association. In specific, the truck that we propose to retire out, ARFF truck 88, lacks modern safety features such as anti-rollover alarms and anti-lock brakes, which in turn presents an increased safety risk to firefighters. And these older trucks do have a history of rolling over at airports across the country. So that's a significant issue for me as the chief. Also, we have a lot of aging components, and in specific with this truck, we have a degrading water tank, which is essentially breaking apart and starting to plug up the foam systems that are present in the truck. So we do have increasing maintenance and aging issues with the truck. And as a plus, by purchasing the new truck, we will be increasing our frontline firefighting water capacity by 1,500 gallons of delivery. So, and that is, oh, and one thing I would mention on surplus of the old truck, we do have a surplus system for surplusing that truck out, and that goes out through port distribution to an auction, a public auction for our older equipment. They will sometimes wind up at general aviation airports. They're small. Sometimes they can wind up in construction or whoever wants or feels they have a need for a vehicle that has that kind of water delivery. And with that, I will turn it over to Tanya.
Thank you. With regard to the schedule, our engineering department and the fire department worked together to develop specifications. And these specifications were submitted or provided to Oshkosh for a quote. And that quote was then reviewed by the HDAC group to determine whether it was in compliance with their contract or not. And actually, we just received the verification this morning that it is in compliance and we're all ready to go there, provided that the commission action is successful today. And as was mentioned, it will take about a year. And actually, by contract, they must have the vehicle completed within a year's time period. With regard to the budget, we will spend approximately $1.919 million with Oshkosh Airport Products for the vehicle itself. Then we have an estimated $275,000 in terms of staff costs and additional equipment that will then be added to the unit. We are also carrying about 6.8% in terms of contingency over the project costs, and the funding source is the Airport Shared Projects Fund. With that, staff requests your approval of the Executive Director's recommendation to award the contract to Oshkosh Airport Products for the purchase of the ARFF vehicle in the amount of $1,192,649. Thank you.
Any questions? Or motion and second to approve? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So the motion carries. Thanks for the presentation. It looks like a great piece of equipment.
Great. Thank you for your support.
Vince, you've got the last item.
Last one, which is an upgrade to our short-term garage. We also call it P1, the Automated Parking Guidance System. These are the red and green lights. We were one of the first airports in the country to do this. It's hard to believe it's at the end of its useful life, but it's time to replace this with a more modern technology that'll do some additional things for us on customer service, but also on technology too. So Alan is here to present the item.
Thank you very much, Vince. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
As Vince mentioned, this agenda item requests your approval for a public improvement contract to be awarded to High Point Construction Services, roughly in the amount of $2,100,000 to replace the P1 parking guidance system. So I'm here to walk us through that. If you recall back in May, we talked about some of the history. The P1 parking guidance system is very unique. I think it was one of the first ones installed in Portland. It's been a tremendous success, a lot of customer satisfaction benefits, energy efficiency benefits, and so forth. Unfortunately, it is at the end of its useful life as a high technology piece of equipment and system. The spare parts are no longer available. There were very few of these installed in the country, so there isn't a secondary market for us to go buy the spare parts that we need to keep it up and running. So maintenance has found that it's getting to be almost impossible to make repairs. One thing you should also know is that the new system is going to not only replace in a like-for-like, but it's going to provide a lot of additional benefits. The new system that we're proposing to install is going to be based on cameras instead of just ultrasonic sensors to detect a vehicle presence. So as you can see from the photos, there are cameras on the sensors now. They're mounted on the middle of the drive aisle instead of over each stall. I think one of the benefits to that personally is that there'll be a lot less visual clutter. There'll be fewer lights. We won't have one light over every stall, but we'll have a light that indicates whether there's an open stall in a group of four parking areas. In summary, some of the other benefits, we talk about the improved information for the customers. We'll improve the entry sign. Currently, when you drive into the parking garage, it just tells you if a particular level is open or full. Now we'll have an actual number of stalls. We foresee a time when people will be looking at the system on their app before they come to the airport, and they'll be able to know in advance what their target floor is to park in the garage. So really relieve the stress on parkers. Another major benefit is, if you recall from the presentation in May, and this is coming to fruition now, we will provide a mobile app that looks like this, so that if when you come back from your trip, you've forgotten where you've parked, you'll be able to type in your license plate number or something close to your license plate number for those of us who haven't memorized it, and the system will guide you to your vehicle. So that's another tremendous benefit for our customers. So now, not every benefit just flows to our customers. Some of the benefits flow to us as well. We're going to be able to capture either video or still images when a particular vehicle parks in a stall. One of the benefits for us is that that gives us proof positive. We will know if somebody's lost their ticket exactly when they parked and when they pulled out of that stall. We'll have positive evidence so that we can charge them fairly and accurately for their time in our garage. The other thing is that I think we talked about this in May too, but just to refresh your memory, we have to create on a nightly basis a license plate inventory. We have to log all the vehicles in the garage. Now that we have cameras, we can automate that process. So it's a huge labor savings, and that provides benefits not only for revenue control, but it also provides benefits for law enforcement to be able to locate vehicles in the garage and exactly, you know exactly where they are. The project schedule really was heavily front-end loaded as a new technology system. We really had to pay a lot of attention to what was available in the market. We had to do a lot of research. So you see that reflected in the schedule. Currently, the milestone we're looking at is requesting your approval to move forward with a public improvement contract. We anticipate that the project will be designed and installed in calendar 2018. It should be ready to go first of 2019. Back in May, I was here to request your approval to put this through a competitive RFP as opposed to a simple competitive bid. And with that approval, we issued an RFP back in May. We received five proposals. Three of those proposers were shortlisted for some extensive interviews and follow-up questions. Out of that analysis, the evaluation panel selected High Point Construction Services for many reasons, but one of the significant reasons, I think, was that it's a small woman-owned business, and she included multiple subcontractors that were also small businesses. So you're seeing with the project, we're achieving a very significant small business participation goal of 23%. There are quite a few risks, I think, that we've identified and we've developed some mitigation plans for with this project. First and foremost, the new technology using cameras is a little bit innovative. There are several airports in the country that are using it, and we've talked to them for their input and feedback. What we built into the contract was a 30-day trial installation. So for a very minor fee, $15,000, we get 10 sensors installed, we get all the software, we get to play with it, we get to spray it with water, do whatever we want, and make a final determination before we move forward with the ultimate design and installation. It is very IT-oriented, and so we have purposefully included our port IT staff in the process every step of the way through the proposals and analysis, and we feel very good about that. These projects also, being IT-related, they tend to have schedule delays, so we identified that as a risk. Mitigation factors there are the liquidated damages, which are pretty standard for construction contracts, just to make sure that the contractor knows that there are costs to the port for delay. And we're also going to be very careful about maintaining the operation and functionality of the existing system. We're not going to tear the existing system out before we install the new system. And we have a lot of layers of attention in terms of staff dedicated to the project. The project budget is $3.38 million in total. That's the $2,090,000 for High Point Construction Services, little over $1 million for port staff and contracted services. We've identified a $250,000 contingency amount, and the Port Cost Center will be the funding source for this project. So in summary, staff requests approval of the executive director's recommendation to award the public improvement contract to High Point Construction Services for the parking guidance system replacement project.
Thank you. Any questions? Gary?
I think it was identified some time ago that this current system had some problems, or it was hard to troubleshoot that system and find problems or deal with those problems and maintenance and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been thoroughly vetted with this new system?
Yeah, that's a good question. The problems with the system really are the availability of parts. The troubleshooting and identifying where the problem is pretty straightforward other than the software end of it. There's really, there's no guarantee that the new software will be any more helpful than the old software. But certainly we intend to test it all out. And I think that's, from an engineering point of view, that's the best we can do. We've asked questions of other users of the system. We've identified a few weak areas of the technology that we want to really test out. For example, because it's a camera, it has a hard time dealing with high contrast images. So where you have backlighting, a sunny outdoor back view, and then it's a darker interior in the foreground, the cameras can have a hard time discerning that. So we're thoroughly going to test that. One of the other challenges we had with the existing system was water intrusion into the sensors. And it wasn't that it was raining in the garage necessarily, but it was that condensation and moisture. So we're going to thoroughly test that. Our maintenance folks are involved, so they get to put their hands and eyes on it. And, yeah, hopefully we have a system that's easily maintained going forward.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah.
Just a quick question. This is the vote is to approve the replacement of the existing system. Where does this fall within the long-term planning around additional parking and new facilities? Is this expected to expand as that does, or is that a separate consideration?
Yeah, we will we'll be upgrading all of the future systems to the new technology out in the second parking garage and the the parking portions of the Packer project as well. So right now, the short-term garage is the one that's most in need of replacement. It's the initial technology. P2 was a little bit better, but it'll be included in all of the systems going forward.
One thing I'd like to add on that is we anticipated that future growth of the system. So we had the proposers include unit pricing for their hardware to protect us against any undue future inflation in the cost, knowing that these systems are proprietary and you're pretty much going to sole source whoever system you select. We've built in that price protection.
I had a question on your considerations around your IT risk mm-hmm. and your mitigation strategies. When you talked about in your write-up that the vendor software will run within the port IT system and environment, and then the cloud software will run in the vendor-controlled environment, I was wondering what considerations about security risk were.
Great question. One of the big ones that came up is that because the vendor will be providing support for not only their cloud-based software, but for the software that runs in our environment, they're going to need VPN connections. And we talked to them extensively about the number of folks that we would have to provide credentials to on their end. The vendor that we selected, Park Assist, has the most fully developed support team. And so they had the highest number of people. They indicated that there might be as many as 30 people on their end who at any given point in time, since they have a 24/7 response, might be trying to connect to our system. So our IT folks are aware of that. We have a very robust two-factor identification process for VPN connections to our network. But it's definitely a point of concern. It's going to be very closely monitored and coordinated. Are there particular ideas or thoughts you have on how best to address that?
I'm just concerned with the amount of information and personal information you'll have because of the location.
Great point.
So cybersecurity, so it's a little bit.
Yes.
I'm not, and I know there's all kinds of challenges, the two-factor or multi-factor identification.
Right.
And the number 30 for VPN, that's a very small number. So
okay.
Not too concerned about that. I mean, there's debates on the multi-factor mm-hmm. identification, but I was wondering mostly about the privacy concerns, and then
yes.
And then there's privacy concerns, and then unfortunately, I think you have to take into account in this day and age what can be done in terms of just another security risk for the port
mm-hmm.
if that's a tunnel.
So, yeah, okay, great. Thanks for elaborating a little bit. A couple of things there. One thing that's working in our favor is that this system does not connect at all to our cardholder data environment. So we're not processing credit card payments through the system. There's no financial information in this system. We viewed that as a plus. The existing system that we have is integrated with revenue control. The parking guidance and the revenue control, you know, paying for your parking, is all through one software package. So that was a risk. We're eliminating that risk with this project. We also had identified a risk because you can enter somebody's license plate number and you can find their vehicle. And there was some concern about that feature being misused. We're looking at a mitigation strategy there that we don't quite have yet in the project, but it's called geofencing. The idea there would be with that cell phone app to limit the use of that app to within our property boundaries. So you can't be at home in Beaverton and wondering where somebody is and typing in license plate numbers randomly. You've got to physically be on the property. That's not foolproof, but that's a mitigation strategy that we're working with the vendor to add to their system. But you're right, there are those issues. The other thing with the data storage of license plate numbers and who was where when, I didn't realize this, but many law enforcement agencies have license plate recognition systems all up and down our highways. They may be coming to Airport Way sometime soon, so we won't be the first agency or entity to be capturing this information. We've gone through a legal review, and Eric Smith is here, and he can address this some more, but it was decided that this is very common, and one of the things that we'll do is we won't be retaining this information. It'll probably have about a 30-day shelf life, and then it'll be overwritten and lost. So we won't be keeping these. We have no intent or need to keep this data for a long period of time.
And just on that, the revenue control system is PCI compliant. We're required to be the payment card industry compliant, so we are audited on that every year. And so we do have the appropriate safeguards to manage that. But it's, so I do think there are some benefits here to separating license plates from the rest of the system. But even within the revenue control system, we are at least PCI compliant.
Good questions. It's just amazing what's beneath the surface of these things that you could get into trouble with. So yeah. Good answers as well.
Thank you.
Is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks
Thank
very
you.
Much. And we can adjourn the meeting, I think. Thanks, everybody.